Everyone, we do want to get started because our guest today does have quite a busy schedule, and we do have to wrap up bang on 2 o'clock. So the usual reminders: please turn off your mobile phones if you haven't already. Upcoming events, I'm not going to mention those. Please check the club website because it is going to be quite busy over the next few weeks with a lot of interesting speakers. Today, however, we're very honored to have the Honorable Tim Grosser, New Zealand's Minister of Trade, also the minister responsible for climate change negotiations, with us. And he's had a punishing schedule. It was either last night or the night before that he slept in Bogota International Airport, and yet is still awake to join us here. I think it should be said that New Zealand is really the FCC's second favorite country. The favorite, of course, would be Samoa. No, sorry, I was told not to mention that, so he's going to be in a bad mood now. No, seriously, when New Zealand was playing Samoa, I was rooting for New Zealand because New Zealand gives this club a lot of face. Bill English, the Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister, was here last year, and now, of course, Minister Grosser is joining us. Minister Grosser is actually Scottish, born in Perth, Scotland, and upgraded to New Zealand in 1958, as evidenced by New Zealand's thrashing of Scotland on Saturday afternoon. He was chief negotiator for New Zealand during the GATT-Uruguay negotiations and went on to be both New Zealand's ambassador to the WTO and chair of the always sticky agricultural negotiations right up until a few months before the 2005 ministerial here in Hong Kong, when he went into politics, which brought him to his current positions. He's going to talk to us about trade without borders, how nimble New Zealand beats protectionism. Minister Grosser.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Tom. How you managed to get around my injunction not to talk about the war with Samoa, but still make the point, I thought was a remarkable piece of finesse. But I guess we'll get over it. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to acknowledge my parliamentary colleague, the Honourable Marion Street, the opposition spokesperson on trade. We follow bipartisan policy on this issue. And it's a great privilege to come here to this very famous club and give you some views about trade. First of all, let me tell you that I no longer have an open mind on trade issues at the level of high aggregation. I mean, just think about Hong Kong, for example. Hong Kong developing to this extraordinary state it is without the benefits of international trading linkages. Think about Korea, one of the poorest countries in the world that has dragged itself up into a position of great strength, the 11th largest economy in the world, if I'm not mistaken. That would have been unimaginable had it not been for what were considered technical provisions of the GATT, called the MFN provision, allowing Korea to take advantage of trade negotiations that might have been between, say, two European countries prior to the formation of the EC over things like footwear, that gave them their opportunity to make their effort and drag their country up to where they are today. I think of China today, extraordinary growth of income, unparalleled literally in the history of the world, without access to international capital, often from their own overseas Chinese people, of course, without access to markets. Yes, they're now engaged in this very difficult process of trying to move to a consumption-based economy, moving away from such a high dependence on export-led growth. But could they ever have achieved this without the access to a relatively open international trade and payment system? The answer's got to be a resounding no. And if I look at New Zealand's own economic history, we started off in terms of European history of New Zealand, in terms of our economic raison d'etre, essentially based on what was then free access for farm products to Britain. And when I was born, in Scotland before I came to New Zealand, 90% of New Zealand's total exports were to Britain. We've since transformed our orientation to Asia. Britain has gone from 90% when I was born to about 4% of our total exports, and our future is overwhelmingly in Asia. But in every case, the common link is trade. And as I say, I'm sort of, Tom, beyond argument at this point in my career on the underlying point of principle. Now, we've just negotiated an FTA with Hong Kong. I'll try and put this in a broader strategic framework, but let me sort of reach immediately to the conclusion that I think is valid. For Hong Kong, this is not a matter of commercial importance, but it is a matter of considerable strategic importance to Hong Kong. The fact is that Hong Kong has stood outside the huge shift into FTA development over the last 15 years, largely as a matter of principle, actually. And I commend them for that. As I've said to Financial Secretary John Chang and the Honourable Rita Lau yesterday in signing the agreement, probably we could all agree that had the rest of the world been prepared to stick with the multilateral solutions solely, we would have been in a better space. But we are where we are, ladies and gentlemen. That has not proved the way the world has worked. And FTAs are at the center of the process of Asia-Pacific integration. And essentially what Hong Kong is doing in playing a card with New Zealand yesterday in signing this agreement is saying we're part of this game. And therefore, while of little commercial significance given the small size of the New Zealand market, this is a very important policy step for Hong Kong. And I know now that they've got an agenda ahead of them with very significant economies. I think that this will pave the way for Hong Kong to move forward. From our point of view, this is impossible to look at the deal with Hong Kong without also considering the fact that New Zealand is the only developed country in the world to have a comprehensive FTA with China. And last week, a statistic that we knew we would hit at some point, we just weren't quite sure when, came out, which showed that China had surpassed the United States as New Zealand's second largest export market, after a phenomenal growth of New Zealand exports of around 40% in the last 12 months. I mean, this is 40% in the background of the greatest contraction of world trade that we've seen for 70 years. Our exports to Hong Kong increased by 13%, which itself is a stellar performance. And we see just enormous opportunities for our small country in linking into the greater China area. I think it's going too far to say, metaphorically speaking, that the greater China area will play a similar role for New Zealand in the 21st century that the British market played for New Zealand in the early 20th century. I think that's going too far. But it's somewhere in that space will lie, I believe, the truth. We produce goods, services, whether it's education, high-quality tourism, sophisticated but niche manufacturing products, and most of all, high-quality, safe foodstuffs that is part of the Chinese growth process. I think we have a great future here in this region. Now, I want to step back from that and look a little bit strategically at the development of international trade across two broad themes. One is where we are with the multilateral process, what used to be the GATT, now is the WTO, and then look at the emerging architecture and the political issues surrounding that in the Asia-Pacific region. First of all, the multilateral process, and I've spent years of my life defending it and trying to advance our interests, working very closely, I might say, with a number of names. I don't know whether they mean anything to you, great Hong Kong representatives over the years, people like Stuart Harbinson, if my memory fails me, I should have a list of these people I've worked with, Michael Cartland, people probably not known to the community of Hong Kong, but actually behind the scenes have done a stellar job for Hong Kong, working with like-minded countries such as New Zealand to try and promote the multilateral trading system. And the benefit of that, frankly, has been tested and come through with, if not flying colours, a very creditable pass rate in the last 18 months. I think I'm now saying something that's very conventional, but nevertheless it's worth noting that the world has just emerging, and to some extent not yet complete, from the world's greatest threat to international prosperity in 70 years. At the start of 2009, I asked myself, is this going to happen again? I mean, as we started to look into the abyss of what looked like the beginnings of a world depression, are we really going to see not only the implosion of world financial institutions, but go all the way down the 30s model into perhaps not competitive devaluations given the floating rate exchange system for most countries, but certainly protectionist beggar thy neighbor policies? I think it was a real question to ask, frankly. And the fact that we didn't go down that track was primarily because of the acquis, to use the French word, literally in English, the acquired achievements of 8 rounds of multilateral trade negotiations. Everybody likes to throw off at the system because it's so slow, because it moves forward at this glacial pace. But the reality is that not only would the economic development of China, Hong Kong, Korea not been possible for the reasons that I tried to illustrate earlier, but I believe we would have had a far, far deeper depression with political consequences that are a little difficult to foresee, but they would all be bad, had we not been able to hold the forces of protectionism very largely at bay because of the existing structure of the rules underwriting the multilateral trading system. Unfortunately, that system is a system of evolution, not revolution. And certain people who expect it to produce revolutionary results will always be proven wrong. The system is not capable of revolutionary change. It is capable only of evolutionary change. And it's only when you look back, as I just have tried to illustrate, on 40 to 50 years of achievement, you can see just what a considerable achievement it's done in underwriting development, prosperity, and stability for economies of very different types around the world. But right now, the system is stuck. As I say, using a typical New Zealand metaphor, like a racing yacht caught without any wind in its sails. When the wind will come along will be for exogenous political reasons. I can't forecast it. I think it's probably not going to happen this year. I hope to be proven wrong, but I can't see it at this stage. In the circumstances, the rational approach for a country like New Zealand or an economy like Hong Kong is to just never go away, is to sit there and allow this process to continue until such time as a fair wind comes. I do not believe we can have a global economy with global supply chains and without a functioning multilateral trading system. So we just have to be patient, ladies and gentlemen, bear with the jokes and the jibes against the multilateral trading system, and in the meantime, try and advance our agenda through the FTA track. Now, this is a particular relevance to the Asia-Pacific region, obviously. I mean, it's maybe a cliche to talk about the Asia-Pacific as the world's most dynamic growth region, but you can almost feel this physically, I would argue, when you move out of this region that we live in and go back into Europe. You can almost physically feel the difference. The sense of progress here is unmistakable. When you go back into Europe, as I do, obviously, for professional reasons frequently, you do not have that sense of progress, optimism, and emerging strength. So, yes, it is a cliche to talk about the Asia-Pacific as the huge growth opportunity, but it is the most fundamentally important truth of the world economy. And I think New Zealand is privileged to have developed, along with Australia, a position we were part of that story. Now, the way this was going to develop had several alternative political economy models in front of it. One was the Bogle goals of APEC, which I don't think have been particularly important for reasons that I could expound on, but will spare you the lecture. What is actually happening instead is that we are moving towards what probably will in 20 to 30 years' time be an APEC-wide free trade area of trade and investment integration, but we're doing it in a different way. We're doing it through FTAs. Now, those of you who followed the academic debate, typified in the exchanges between Bhagwati and Bergston 10, 15 years ago in the pages of The Economist, somewhere in the audience is an economist, columnist. You will recall, well, I've just met somebody coming up the stairs who claimed to be. You will recall that the criticism was, a criticism that essentially was correct, by the way, and the reason why Hong Kong stood out against the momentum for so long was summed up in the metaphor of the either the spaghetti in the bowl or the noodles in the rice bowl. In other words, if we advanced the process of trade and investment integration through bilateral deals, we would be advancing something of such complexity that it would become a mess, like a bunch of noodles in a rice bowl, if you wish. And also, there was a lot of criticism of FTAs because they were very low quality. Well, that criticism essentially is true. But what is actually happening today is a little more sophisticated and is coming in after the event to clean up some of this mess. The first thing that's happening is that while there were a lot of poor quality FTAs negotiated in the 1990s, more modern FTAs that are being negotiated have two characteristics. One is that they actually are of very high quality. The New Zealand's FTA with China is effectively, bar a very unimportant and technical exception relating to a provision in the Chinese Protocol of Accession to the WTO, completely comprehensive. The FTA we've negotiated with Hong Kong is completely comprehensive. The other aspect to this development that is not really understood, in my opinion, outside professional trade policy theorists and practitioners such as myself, is what I call convergent FTAs. So increasingly, they're not solely bilateral deals, but they're part of an emerging matrix, often leading to convergence amongst these FTAs. Now, the best example I know that's actually done, signed, and sealed, and although there's one or two transitional issues to be attended to, basically delivered from the 1st of January, is the merging of the FTA between Australia and New Zealand on the one hand, and the FTA, AFTA, of the Southeast Asian countries. So, I mean, it's had almost no attention given to it politically, but it actually is extremely important in terms of the emergence of Asia-Pacific architecture. What you have got is a fully comprehensive FTA that brings together the Australasian economies together with Indonesia, the Philippines, Vietnam, Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, and the other countries of Southeast Asia with this unpronounceable name or acronym of ANSFTA, which is, I'm sorry about the name, we trade negotiators try and deal with substance, we're not good on PR, it stands for the Australia-New Zealand-ASEAN Free Trade Area. And the rules of origin, which is the technical difficulty behind the metaphor of the spaghetti in the bowl, or the noodles in the rice bowl, we have area-wide rules of origin that are cleaning up the discontinuities of these FTAs in the process. So while a theoretician would never have suggested this as the first best way to advance it, the theoretician would always have said go multilateral, we're sort of getting there in this uneven but very interesting and quite new evolutionary process. Now another FTA of this type has just begun negotiation in Melbourne 2 weeks ago. And I am very proud to say it was fundamentally growth on a New Zealand and Singaporean initiative where we were getting very tired of the slow pace of our strategic partners and decided to negotiate an FTA largely to try and achieve two things, both of which, well, one of which has already been achieved, the other which may be, which was to act as a bridge between the CER and the AFTA, or the ASEAN FTA, and cause a merger over time. 10 years on, that's now been achieved. But the other aspect of it was we were both at that stage trying to establish an FTA with the United States. Singapore more for strategic reasons. They want to keep the US very much in the Asia-Pacific region, bound into the emergence of the Asia-Pacific economic architecture. New Zealand for both that and commercial reasons. And we formulated a concept which we call Pacific Five. Now, it eventually took root as a four-grouping or a configuration of New Zealand, Singapore, Chile, and Brunei Darussalam. And right at the point that we were starting to look at extending this agreement to financial services, the United States started sniffing around. We now have got a new initiative out of that called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is another convergent FTA. Obviously, politically, it's centered on the United States. Dimitrios Marantis, Deputy USTR, has described it now as a centerpiece of U.S. trade policy, which I think is very pleasing from our perspective, and involves eight of the APEC countries, the original four, plus the United States, plus Australia, Peru, and intriguingly, Vietnam. We held the first negotiating round in Melbourne two or three weeks ago. It was attended by our senior officials, not ministers. And our senior official, who a friend of mine worked with many years, told me there were over 200 people in the room. So it's almost like the GATT circa 1980 in that sense. So step back, ladies and gentlemen. What are we talking about here? We're talking about a series of initiatives which are all moving in an inchoate way towards the concept of Asia-Pacific economic integration, in which New Zealand is absolutely front and center of most of these initiatives. And I'm now pleased to say, now that Hong Kong has put its toe in the water, the FTA water will now be part of that process unquestionably. Behind this are some very intriguing political issues. There are two superpowers, China and the United States, and two enormous economies, one of which will be a superpower, India, which will be a superpower, I've no doubt about that, and Japan. Still, on a non-PPP basis, the second economy in the world, we should never forget this, Japan is still 10%, or I think it's 9-point-something percent, roughly 10% of world GDP. Now, Japan obviously has problems participating in this process because it is still yet to confront the issue of comprehensive treatment of liberalization, which is me being extremely diplomatic and saying about agriculture. And I think I shouldn't really talk. I'm not prepared to talk about Samoa and the rugby. They shouldn't have to talk about agriculture and trade liberalization. That's fair. China, in developing the first FTA with New Zealand, has laid down a very important policy challenge on the table. China is saying to the world, we can play in this game. We can do comprehensive agreements. We don't have to have exceptions. There's effectively, by some timing provisions that give a little more time for adjustment on the Chinese side, no special and differentiated treatment in favor of developing countries inside this FTA. This is a bold challenge that China's put on the table. I just think people don't realize it because it's with a country of New Zealand's significance, i.e. very small. But that's the policy. I mean, this is typical, as my understanding from speaking to people who do understand China, I don't pretend to be a sinologist, typical Chinese approach. Start a new direction with something small and see how it goes, and then move into the big territory. India. Well, there's a fascinating strategic issue. I'm a bit ahead of some other people's opinion on this. I have generally a view of power that says, don't ever try and stop power. Don't ever try and contain power. India is going to be an economic superpower. Since it started the process of liberalization of its economy and getting rid of the permit Raj, usually put around the date of 1991 when Prime Minister Rao and the then Finance Minister, and of course now Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, was leading the charge against a very autarkic system of economic policy inherited as a consequence of the big, great benefit of the London School of Economics. And they have now grown from a situation where I remember once having an argument with somebody in Geneva in the mid-1980s or late 1980s when I said, do you realize that India and New Zealand have one thing in common other than cricket and the English language? And the person said, what is that? I said, we have the same share of world trade, 0.3%. Now, I mean, think about it. How is it possible that a country of then 800 or 900 million people, as it then was, could have a share of world trade the same size as New Zealand in those days? Well, that's a measure of their introspection. But they have now moved massively outside this. They are developing great strengths that you will know. I don't need to lecture this group of people on that. And we believe that on current extrapolation, the Indian economy in 15 years will be around the size of China today. Now, sure, we hope, expect China will have moved on. But to imagine that we could have the economic grunt or what is China today in as little as 15 years, I think is an indication of just how important it is to accommodate India. Now, India is not formally part of APEC. I believe they should be for the reasons that I've just stated. And I've started an FTA negotiation with India in the last little while. The question of the United States, do I need to... Right. Okay, I'll end on the question of the US, and I shall be a little diplomatic in my comments. That's the voice of a journalist, not a politician speaking. It's the voice of a man who mentioned Samoa when I explicitly asked him not to mention it. I think it's the worst kept secret in the world that the United States has a major problem on trade. My belief is that this is not a new problem. My belief, as I've argued many times in the past, that this has been 20 years in the making. We should not forget that the NAFTA, this giant agreement between Mexico, the United States, and Canada, passed the U.S. House of Representatives by a mere handful of votes. I think it was either two or three. That was 20 years ago. We should not forget that President Clinton, in his first presidency, was humiliated on the floor of the House by failure to get more than a handful of Democrat votes behind fast-track negotiating authority. This is not, ladies and gentlemen, a new problem. The Obama administration is struggling with this. I'm very pleased from a purely New Zealand point of view that the Obama administration has passed its first test of fire with healthcare reform. I know there's some way to go yet. And I hope that they will get onto this agenda. But this is a difficult process. The United States has been the driver strategically and economically and philosophically behind trade liberalization in the Asia Pacific, and the success that the administration has in confronting this agenda will determine their place in the future. So, ladies and gentlemen, what I've tried to do is put the you may have difficulty in saying, why would New Zealand, little tiny New Zealand and Hong Kong, which has no trade barriers, do a deal? What does it mean? Fundamentally, it's a part of this broader strategic focus that I've tried to sketch out. I'm pleased to be here today. I'm going off to southern China because, of course, we look at this as an integrated way with the Chinese issue. And I'm pleased that we're working with Hong Kong in these joint endeavors. And happy to take any questions you have on this, or if anyone's silly enough to open up the issue of climate change, I'm happy to talk about that too. Thank you.
Mr. Grosser, thank you for that very interesting tour of Asia and the issues that you're wrestling with. Let's go straight to the floor, because we only have about 10 minutes. Please keep your questions really short and succinct, and we might be able to get in one more before time is up. And can you also identify yourself when you ask the question and tell us where in New Zealand you're from? Because I think we got the whole community here. First
no,
question
no
there.
No questions about the war, please.
And then in the back.
Matt Flynn. I work for a consulting company mostly focused on shipping and trade issues. So in the, this is quite educational for me. I've never been to New Zealand, but the free trade approach, useful to understand. But can you say anything about other trade export development policy of the New Zealand government, whether it's infrastructure or support to export industries, these type of things for reference?
Well, we don't provide subsidies to anyone, and we haven't for 25 years. Look. To answer your question in a fair and honest way would require me now to start down an agenda which would look at infrastructure, which would look at the education system, training, and a whole series of issues. Just let me sum it up in a general sense. When you do trade deals, you're actually not adding a buck to anybody's bottom line. All you're doing is creating an opportunity, and it's up to the private sector to take advantage of those opportunities, both in trade in goods and trade in services. Now, the ability of New Zealand, which you could put any country into this policy equation that I'm drawing here, to do that depends on whether or not you have sound economic structures in place that make your people competitive in world markets. So in a sense, the trade agenda is not a separate, it's not in some sealed, hermetically sealed box that's separate from general economic policy. And I think I'd rather just stick to that very generalized answer rather than go into the detail of where our government is moving on those complex issues.
Thank you. I think in the back.
Thank you. Hi, Paul Jury. I work for a bank from Wellington. A couple of years ago when the free trade agreement was signed with China, I really queried the benefits to New Zealand in this. I know that we've seen an increase in trade. I think a lot of that would have come anyway. So what's been the benefits to New Zealand over the last 2 years?
Well, the benefits to New Zealand would have come, but probably not to the same ferocity. There's no question that what's happening is now being phased in. We'll build on the inherent dynamics. The drivers of the New Zealand-China trading relationship are the underlying dynamics of internal economic change, and that I agree with you. But the benefit of the FTA is to accelerate that process. So if we take an issue like wine, for example, there's a 14% MFN tariff rate on wine. That will be phased out, I think, 2016, 2017, I forget which year it is. New Zealand, as you would know, coming from New Zealand, is a serious player these days in world wine markets. That gives New Zealand a very considerable competitive edge. Now, it's not enough if you don't have a good wine industry, an FTA with China is not going to do the trick for you, but it certainly will help.
Question in the far corner, please, Simon.
Minister, I'm David Livingstone from the Australian Consulate. Thank you for your talk. That was a great explanation and description of New Zealand's trade liberalisation efforts. You mentioned briefly the emerging architecture in the Asia-Pacific region, and I just wondered, would you chance your arm and describe what you see as the architecture in, say, 20 years?
Well, I think what will happen in the next 20 years, and we have to use some assumptions when we're looking at something way out like this, and the fundamental assumption is continued peace. What I think will happen is that we will see all of these countries in the APEC region adopt de facto or de jure free trade. How far they will go down the investment track, I'm not so clear. But it just, to me, the logic of the global supply chain makes trade protectionism just faintly ludicrous. Perhaps the best example, it's not mine, but I think it's a brilliant example, is the work done on the Apple iPod. Some of you may have read the business case study that I think just nails that question. So let's assume that we're protectionist forces in the US and we want to stop imports from China. Right, let's stop imports from China. And what are we going to stop? Well, we're going to stop these imports of this thing called the Apple iPod, because that arrives on the East Coast with stamped made in China. So some very clever people deconstructed the Apple iPod, and from memory, the figures go like this. Recommend a retail price, $299. Of that, since 17 different countries are involved in making an iPod, $111 of the value of each purchase of an iPod is the intellectual property that goes to the United States. There are 16 other countries providing components, and the value added according to the analysis by manufacturing it in China is $4. So what comes into Boston or New York or wherever as made in China gives $4 worth of value add to China, $111 to the United States. So what do you want to do? Stop U.S. imports from China? Because that's how it's entered into the U.S. customs statistics. Look, in the modern global supply chain, I mean, protectionism based on the assumption that you've got vertically integrated operations in country X just looks almost ludicrous. So that's why I think that's where we will go. It's the logic of politics and the logic of economic development.
One, maybe two more. I'll ask one and leave the last one to the floor. Correct me if I'm wrong, Minister, but in the great and gathering debate over the renminbi and whether it's overvalued and should appreciate, I don't hear a lot of noise from New Zealand. Given the enormous benefit that your economy would gain from a stronger renminbi, why not? Do you believe the renminbi is overvalued, and are you pushing for revaluation?
Well, you're aware that I was born in Scotland, and there's an old Scottish saying that says, let's face that truly on the face and move on and think about something else. Yesterday I was asked that question, and I said, to the Hong Kong reporter, well, there are many different ways to commit political suicide in public, and answering your question is one of them. I'm not going to buy into that fight. What the underlying issue here is this. To make sense of reality in terms of international politics, we have to subdivide reality into segments. Now, traditionally, the way of doing this in terms of trade is you do not require commitments on currency. There is some vague language in the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade in the preambular language about encouraging movement towards convertibility, but that's as far as it goes. And I would argue that they were very wise to compartmentalize reality in that way. The old phrase, the excellent, the enemy of the good, once again applies. Now, I do understand the underlying point, Tom, that the growth of massive surpluses in China, some $2.4 trillion currently, adding about, $500 billion or something of that ilk each year, is putting amazing stress on the trading system. We've gone through this before, of course, in the 1980s, when Japan was then accumulating similarly massive foreign exchange, and there was strong demand for currency disciplines. I'm not going to stick my head on the block by telling you what I think should happen. I just call for cool heads to prevail.
I'm afraid we are going to have to. Okay, last question here then, and then we will have to wrap it up.
Thank you. Jane Drake Bockman, another Aussie, I'm sorry. But you suggest to us that we should be patient about the WTO and bear with it until a fair wind prevails, and meanwhile get on with comprehensive and convergent well-designed FTAs, even plurilaterals. My question is, can you also imagine in the meantime getting on with some non-comprehensive plurilaterals? And I'm thinking, of course, of the services agenda in particular. Many services providers feel that liberalisation in this sector has been rather hostage to agricultural progress. Can you imagine in the WTO or elsewhere being supportive of getting some plurilaterals off the ground in services that might not be comprehensive, that is, might be standalone?
I'm not closed to that idea, but the political logic behind the single undertaking, you'll usually find you confront that full on. And especially with respect to developing countries. I mean, if you try and advance that argument with, say, Brazil, when Brazil's overwhelmingly interest in the agriculture agenda, you will just meet a point-blank refusal to move forward conveniently on issues which are of less interest to them. So I still think we're sort of locked in this sort of difficult embrace between the services and the good sides of the equation. I'm not personally strongly of the view that that need be the case, but I strongly suspect that conservatism will continue to prevail.
Please join me in thanking Minister Grosser for a really fascinating talk here today. He leaves us with his political career very much intact, no suicides. We do have, speaking of Samoa, David, we do have a token of our affection, we have a small token for the minister. Let's not get too personal. I just wanted to let you know that it the reference to Samoa was deliberate. It's all going to come right in the end, because we have something that I nicked off a Samoan player in Wan Chai in the early hours of Monday morning. It's the cup you couldn't win on the field.